in your New Testaments to the second chapter of 2 Peter. In just a moment, we want to begin a lesson from a verse or two that are contained in that chapter. We are delighted to be back at home and to see you and to hear of good things that have been going on in Louisville while we have been occupied in the state of Wisconsin. I never have any doubt about things being taken care of. I have preached most of my preaching life in small churches where the absence of one meant serious difficulty. The fact of the matter was that if somebody was out of town, some important job just might not get done. One of the great things about doing things the way the Lord wants them to be done and being blessed to do that is that we don't have any big shots in this church. There's nobody here around which everything swirls. There are just a lot of people, each of whom trying to do his part, and in so many ways doing it well indeed, so that I can be here and there and everything gets done like it just ought to be done, as it usually is. I tell people when I visit in other places that if I sneeze or cough, somebody is bound to say to me, "Would you like me to preach for you?" We have so many capable men in this assembly that do such an effective work. In 2 Peter 2, verses 4 and 5, "For if God spared not angels when they sinned, but cast them down to hell and committed them to pits of darkness to be reserved to judgment, and spared not the ancient world, but preserved Noah with seven others, a preacher of righteousness, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly." This is a somber section of 2 Peter. And it's not that part that I wish to emphasize today, though we need to think about that. That God is unsparing when it comes to his love, because he did not spare his own son, but God is unsparing when it comes to his judgment too. Some of us have known the way of righteousness a long time. We have understood what we needed to do to become the disciples of Jesus and the children of God, and we have not done that, in spite of God's patience and God's love and God's grace. And we need to know that that love and that grace does have an end, and that when the time comes, the same God who is unstinting and absolutely prodigal in the love he gives to us will not withhold judgment upon those who rebel against it. What I want you to think about today is that descriptive phrase about Noah. Noah, a preacher of righteousness. He had a rather long tenure as a preacher. 120 years. I don't expect that. Some people thought I was going to preach that long, but they never anticipated that I would live that long, I think. 120 years of preaching. And, of course, he lived much longer than that, as you know. A preacher of righteousness, a herald of righteousness. And yet, when you consider his statistical success, it was not much of a success. For 120 years of preaching, and this has been a point often made, for 120 years of preaching, he managed to influence only his wife, his three sons, and their wives. I think when we say that, we should know that there are people who hear us who would be delighted, thrilled beyond words to describe, if it could be said of them that they had influenced their loved ones, if no one else, if their children were with them in Christ, if their mates were with them in Christ, if their daughters and sons-in-law were with them in Christ, that would be altogether worth every bit of investment made. And I think all of us can identify in some measure with that. But yet a man who would preach for 120 years and results only 7 people. We look at that as a distinctive statistical failure. And what we know from the hearts of those of us who preach the gospel is that we might not have taken as much comfort from that little response as we should have. Because it would look to us as though for all this work, for all this labor, not much has been produced. But I want to notice, because of that quality in Noah's life, the example that he is to us as an evangelist, a herald of the righteousness of God. First thing I want you to notice, and this really needs to go home, had you ever thought about the question of how Noah earned his livelihood all the time he was building that ark? I mean, they weren't paying him to build that ark. Boat building was not his occupation. That was something as an additional activity that God gave him. Now, it was not insignificant, as you know. It was central to his life. But he had to do something every day to provide for himself and for his wife and 3 little boys. I don't know what he did. Now, you can guess and speculate, as I might, that he probably was a carpenter. But we wouldn't know that for sure. He was a full-time preacher and a full-time worker. And that's something that for many of us just looks like an impossibility. But it's not. What that says about Noah is that, unlike myself, he was never tempted to think about his work as a means of livelihood. Let me tell you, I fear that in myself. Every preacher of the gospel who receives the bounty of his brother's goodness, whose daily livelihood is provided by others who work hard for what they get and share it generously, every one of us in that position has always to examine himself and to say, why are you doing what you're doing? Are you working your 40 or 50 hours a week because that's your occupation and your profession? Or is it an expression of the fact that you're a follower of Jesus? And would you do this, whether anyone shared with you or not? That's a very important question for every gospel preacher who receives of the bounty of others to spend his time entirely in this work needs to ask himself. Noah never did have to ask himself that. A friend of mine some years ago that I remember from the time when he first became a Christian, I was younger than he. He was such a shy young man that if you spoke to him, his face would turn virtually scarlet just from that. He had a humble background, not more than a high school education. And he met and courted a young lady in the church where I was a member. To my shame, I recall that I used to torment them as a young man who had no appreciation for the high calling of romance. I used to torment them by creating one kind of difficulty or another. But he wanted so badly to speak about Christ that he forced himself not only to study, but to speak to others. He worked every day on heavy equipment out at the Naval Depot, very near to McAlester, Oklahoma. And then he would take time for the training class, be involved in speaking, doing whatever he could. In the course of events, he went out to the little churches in the nearby towns and began to speak. And he grew to be very effective. He was a hard worker. And then as he was preaching, he started preaching on the radio. And every summer, Arnold would go out to these small areas, get in a school building, take his bedsheet charts, and on his own, and at his own charge, he would preach in a meeting, get the brethren together, whoever would come together, he would do that. And that would be his summer. So he was teaching Bible classes, home studies, preaching in meetings, not those that were supported well and all that sort of arrangement, and preaching on the radio, preparing those lessons. And somewhere long down the road, when Arnold had been doing this a long time, somebody asked him when he was going to go into full-time preaching. He said he didn't know how he could do any more than he was doing. And he was right. And the sad part about it is that some people, because of their blind conception of professional preaching, wouldn't even recognize him as a gospel preacher. Because we've come in our wisdom to believe that a gospel preacher is somebody, I mean, he is instituted as a gospel preacher, he is inaugurated as a gospel preacher the day the brethren say to him, "We're going to pay you for your work." That, my dear brothers and sisters, is a tragic misconception. A man is a gospel preacher who preaches the gospel, who does it faithfully, who does it selflessly, who does it because he's a child of God, and it concerns him that men and women all around him do not know the way of righteousness and the way of salvation. Noah was a man like that. Who would have supported him? Who would have supported him? There weren't any other people that walked with God. There weren't any others who would have said to him, "Well, you just go on, Noah, with your work and your shipbuilding, and we'll see that you don't have to worry about going down to the shop or the office or wherever you might be working. You just take care of that business." Because this is true, the 6th chapter of Genesis says that Noah found favor in the eyes of God. I don't know what it would be like to be the only man in all the world, in all the generation in which you live, who had a profound concern for doing the will of God, who had nobody else to give him any encouragement, except his own companion, perhaps. And the two of them alone, we talk about difficulty in rearing children in these times. We haven't faced any challenge that will even approximate this one. The two of them alone in the world, surrounded by violence and contempt for God and contempt for man, held fast to the idea that it was our calling as human beings to fulfill the purposes of God. And it was more important to be in fellowship with Him and to have an association with Him that was spiritually and morally powerful and influential, transforming, in fact, that it didn't matter what the rest of the world thought about his behavior. That's a tenacious character. I say to you that so much is he revered for that, that in the prophet Ezekiel he is mentioned as one of three godly men who, in spite of their godliness, could have saved only themselves and the hellish iniquity of the city of Jerusalem in Ezekiel's day. But he was heralded as a godly individual, and I can understand why. He was a remarkable man. And there can be no question, as we look at him as a preacher of righteousness, that he was a noble example for every last disciple. Somebody says, "Well, I'll let those men that have been how shall we say this? I'll let those men that have been called by the brethren to preach, I'll let those men take care of the preaching. I'll let those men who are provided with funds so that they can spend all their time. I'll let them do the work. We can't do that. That's not the way God intended it. Every gospel preacher needs to look at Noah and ask himself if he has this kind of character, and every Christian needs to look at Noah and ask himself if he has this kind of character. Genesis 6:9 says he was a righteous man. I'm telling you, he was. Who grew up in the midst of a swamp as an orchid of holiness. And did it because he wanted to and for no other reason, and with all kinds of pressures and forces swirling about him that would have dragged him in the opposite direction, and many times, I'm sure, virtually almost did. Verse 9 also says he walked with God. He was a man of absolute integrity. And more than that, he was a man of tremendous faith. Hebrews 11 verse 7 says that Noah, by faith, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his house. Why? Because he was warned of things not seen as yet. He didn't believe in what he saw. Had he believed in what he was seeing in the world around, he'd have believed that ungodliness and wickedness was going to triumph. He would have believed that the way to get ahead was to use your ingenuity to get at whoever you can get at and to get whatever you can get. That was the message of the society. The only reason he was different than that is because he believed God. I don't know how God communicated with him in the beginning. We're not told about that. This whole period of the patriarchs leaves us wondering and filled with curiosity about just exactly how God dealt with people. But dealt with him, he did, and if we do not know just exactly the method, there can be no question but what there was a time in Noah's life when God addressed him and he had to make a choice, yes or no. Just as certainly, my friends, as you and I are confronted with God today in the way that's very obvious in his Son, Jesus Christ, and we're having to make up our mind as we are confronted by that whether we're going to say yes or no. It is not to be avoided. We know in our heart of hearts that we have faced that calling many times. Our conscience has called out to us. Something deep within us has stirred. But we have been so occupied with our own plans and with our own ambitions and with our own passions that we have simply said, no time for that now. I cannot deal with that now. I will not deal with that now. And we've got to remember that the consequence of rejecting God's invitation and God's call to you is to abandon yourself to ungodliness and to emptiness and iniquity. And that's something I think that you do not want to do. Noah didn't do that. And he was asked to be right in a world that in its entirety was wicked. You're not asked to do that. You're not asked to stand up all alone and be right and to do right. And yet, coward-like, some of us can't do it. In fact, we choose not to. I appeal, as does every earnest child of God, to those that they know. I appeal to you this morning, who in this assembly are not disciples of the Lord, that you hear the voice of Christ, that you understand the nature of his invitation, and then further than that those of us who have accepted that call, that we understand the nature of our calling in terms of what we are expected to achieve. First of all, to be righteous, and secondly, to be preachers of righteousness. I mean heralds, spokesmen for Christ. Before we get too far from Noah and Mrs. Noah as parents, let me suggest to you what a tremendous thing it was for those little boys to watch their father go to work every day and work hard and then come home after it was over and get out there and start working on that boat, this enormous boat. Noah was a man of such absolute and total integrity that those little lads knew that their father was not just a preacher of righteousness, he was a man of righteousness, and he was a man of goodness, and he was a man of faith. And every word he ever preached had been manifest in daily life from the time they were old enough to recognize who their father was. There was no discontinuity. There was no break between his preaching and his practice, between his character and his message. It was all the same. They were the outworking of the same spirit of earnest faith, confidence in God. Those of us who are parents today need to ask ourselves what our children are seeing in us. And if you answer me by saying, well, they see me going to church all the time, I know that my children could see me preaching all the time too. But that won't cut any ice. Unless the life that I am living day to day in those private circumstances of life speaks the same message that I speak when I'm in a position like this. And I want to tell you with some measure of warning that just because you come to these assemblies and bring your children with you is no guarantee whatsoever that they're going to see what they need to see. What do they see in us? A deep love of God, a deep consecration, a consistency of practice, a willingness to quickly make redress for every wrong, an honest openness, a tender conscience, never brazenly trying to present a stubborn affirmation of righteousness when we know we were not righteous. They heard him preach, but I want to tell you something. They saw him live. And that's the reason those three young men grew up to be just exactly like their father. I don't want to take out the mother's influence. I'm sure it was just as strong. She is to be praised because she bore the burden of her task through this whole period of time and supported her husband against the world. She was a noble and faithful mate. The grandfather of these three boys, Lamech, died 5 years before the flood. Their great-grandfather, Methuselah, died either the year of the flood or in the flood. Now, I want to make the application, and I want to talk to you about Eau Claire, Wisconsin, in the midst of that. If we're going to meet the challenge of this year, we're going to have some integrity about us. Our lives and our teaching must be one. We have to be serious disciples, practicing righteousness in our relationships at home, in our relationships with strangers, in our relationships with friends, in our relationships with workmates. There needs to be an obvious awareness that there is a disciple of Christ here. And we can tell it even if we don't know he's been to church. Even if he does not bring his Bible with him, we know that this man is different, this woman is different and special. We need to have faith, to trust that the things that are real are the things that are yet to come, and to act in every decision we make today on the basis of what God has said is going to be the situation tomorrow. Not what it looks like now. I know the world looks like, in its ungodliness and in its selfishness and in its pride, that it's winning today, but it's not. It's winning nothing. It's dragging itself along in absolute emptiness and misery. A sense of no fulfillment, and at last it's all going to end in total vanity. No one knew the flood would come. I know that that year he spent inside the ark was a tough year, but in some ways we think of it as being a very difficult year, more than the year inside that boat with all those animals, and somebody says, then the stench, I don't know. But that was the great time, don't you understand? That was the great time. Everything he knew only by faith for 120 years was now a palpable, concrete reality. God had vindicated himself. He was not glad for the loss of others, but he was grateful for a God who was faithful to his promise, and all the things that he had been ridiculed for saying now had come to pass. The difficult years is when he had no evidence whatsoever to present to the people that there was a judgment coming. And yet he warned of it. We have to have faith. In too many instances, we are not people of faith because we trust only our present circumstances and the financial situation which we are in, instead of the Word of God which speaks of reality. We also have to build an ark whereby we can save our families. We also have to build an ark whereby others can be redeemed. We know, I think we all understand that I'm not speaking literally. I'm just saying we have to do our work, the work that God has given us to do. Last week in Eau Claire, we were working while you were working here, and I'm reporting on this because you were a part of this. There's no way in the world that you were not a part of what we did in Eau Claire. First of all, because you had financial fellowship with two of us that were up there. And because you added to that the prayers and earnest concern for those, and you have financial fellowship with the young man that's preaching in that particular city. So it was a partnership arrangement, and the fact that some of us were physically there does not mean that the rest of us were not there in effective fact. And I want to tell you about this because it's a part of your labor. But I want to make it clear as I begin that I don't believe that this is the most important thing that happened last week. I don't believe this is more important in the work of this local assembly than the work that went on right here. It was just a part. And I think a significant way in which a group of Christians who are blessed with tremendous ability, we have tremendous ability here. And our great struggle is to find ways to give expression to that in an even broader and profounder way, here in Louisville and anywhere else we can. There are 60,000 people in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. The church actually meets in Altoona, a little suburb to the east. There are 25,000 homes in that city, and in the last 2 weeks, three-quarters of the houses in that city were knocked on, and everybody that was at home was asked if they'd be interested in having a Bible study or coming to some Bible studies that week. There were 43 Christians in addition to the 9 adult disciples that are members of the Eau Claire Assembly who work in this. The largest contingent was from Douglas Hills. There were 17 of us who were adults. But I got to say about those two Macmillan twins that they were right in there with the rest of us, going to the door, handing the invitation, the brochure that announced the meeting and spoke about home Bible study or a Bible correspondence course. And we all remark, and have in the 3 times that these little girls have been with us in these trips, that they are unusual in their ability to go around with a group of adults and be happy and content and to share in the work that's being done. In the process of these 2 weeks, 14,000 pieces were handed out, 14,000 of these brochures, leaflets, whatever you want to call them. 6,000 before we got there, and this past week, 8,000 more. On one day, on Tuesday, when the most of us worked more than any other day, 3,000 were handed out that day. Well, those of you who've gone with us in past years, we went 2 years ago to Dover, New Hampshire, and we went a year ago to Owego, New York. You know what it is to hit the streets. But there was a new dimension here. In time past, we just addressed the doorknob and the door handle. We put that little plastic bag of materials on every door handle in town, but this time we knocked on every door. We spoke to everyone that was at home. We sought and we asked. It was tremendous training for all of us. It was a tremendous experience for all of us. And it will bear its fruit, I think, right here in Louisville, as we have had the experiences that will prepare us to go out and talk to people door to door in parts of the city. But I was a little amazed at what could be achieved. People were there during these 2 weeks for a day or a few days. They came from other churches in Wisconsin. from churches in Minnesota and Illinois, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Kentucky. We're glad to have visiting with us today Frank and Tanya Sullivan, who are from Lewisburg, Tennessee. Frank works along with Morris Norman and the work of evangelism with that congregation, but he's been away from home all summer because he's been working in Romulus, Michigan. And then came and spent this time in Eau Claire to be of help, along with another brother and his wife from the church in Lewisburg. So we were not the only ones. They came from a lot of places, and the great thing about most of them is that they were there at their own charges, taking time from their work, vacation time, and taking care of their own expenses. The people of Eau Claire were overwhelmingly gracious and friendly. No one sicked a dog on us, though we feared that some might. There was a rejection rate of about 1%. It was the conclusion of those that went out. About 1 out of every 100 said, no, I don't want it. I'm this or that or some other thing. I don't want it. About 1 in 100 rejected it. Many thanked us warmly. They were friendly, and so much for the myth of the unfriendly Yankees. They received us well. I don't know what the consequence of all that may be, but we were not killed, we were not slaughtered, we were not attacked. We were received with warmth and friendliness, and I would expect that that can be done countless times again. All of us were impressed with the little church in Eau Claire. 9 adult members, with the children probably told attendance on Sunday, if they don't have visitors, about 18 or 20. They recently were reduced. That number is the present number. They were recently reduced because 5 members of family moved out of town, and that hurt. Let me tell you about those 3 families. One is the family that we are associated closely with, David Disselkamp and his wife. She is the daughter of Willis Kay, who is an elder over in Galena. Her name is Robert, and they have 4 children, 3 little boys and a daughter. And then you have Greg Kay's and his wife Heidi. Greg is an Arkansas boy, and Heidi is a Wisconsin girl, and they met down at a college in Searcy, Arkansas. He is a doctor who is in his residency for family practice in the university hospital there in Eau Claire. And they have 2 little children, and they are working earnestly. Greg's parents do not understand the strange conservatism that he has been drawn into by this girl that he married. Her parents are members of the little church in Red Wing, Minnesota. In fact, they are the backbone of that congregation. And they are there and working. The other family came up from Indiana. The name of Eve, Bill Eve and his wife and children. He is an insurance agent in the city. And then there's one sister whose husband is a rather uncooperative unbeliever, and her daughter, who are faithful Christians. They could only come 3 nights at the gospel meeting, and came to me on Wednesday evening tearfully and said, we won't be able to see you again. But they said, we really do appreciate what's going on. But they were feeling rather joyful because this was the most they'd been allowed by her husband to participate in something like this ever before. Thankful and grateful. That's the church in this city. And they set themselves to provide housing for everybody who came and to provide several meals for them. What they did, as I said, as Paul said about some folk in the 8th chapter of 2 Corinthians, they did above what they were able to do. Because it was their mind to do it, and because they wanted to do something in that city. If we multiplied the efforts of these few people in that city by the number of people that are in this congregation, there is no telling what we could achieve. I said to them when I first spoke, I do not feel sorry for you. We sit down here and sometimes congratulate ourselves on our blessings. But the problem is our blessings have become our curse. Because we are so comfortable where we are and feeling so good about it all that we don't recognize that we too are sitting in a city that is going straight to perdition. And that we need urgently, urgently to be out doing something about it to the last man. They know who they are. And they know what they've got to do. And there are no slack hands among them. I would to God, I pray to God, and I will work to this end, that we don't have any slack hands in this assembly. People just want to come here and sit and vegetate. Because that's just a way to be lost. And to do it in the meeting house. And we don't want you to be lost. Brother and sister, I tell you, if I could, somewhere along the line, if we can send a spark into your heart and make you realize who you are and what you have to do and the privilege you have to be a part of it, then that's exactly what I'm going to do, what others here are going to do. I appreciate more than I can tell you the people that go to this task from this congregation. I would hope and pray that they would leaven us all to the task, bring back stories of joy and delight. These trips do more for us than they do for the people we go to help. Stir us and encourage us and make us realize the width and breadth and height of the task that is ours. Most of this that I'm telling you is in the news and notes, and you can get the details of it. We had a wonderful week. As a consequence of the time, about 13 adult people who were absolutely raw new contacts made as a consequence of this effort came to the meeting. One was a university professor from the city and his wife. They spoke very positively and glowingly of what was said, and it was plainly said. One was a young wife who came three times and said she wanted a home study. The first night she was there, her eyes filled with tears. There's obviously a deep emptiness and need in her and a joy at having found something. And then there was an older man, he was in his 50s. He's young by now. He was an appraiser for the highway department. Wilma and I came up to the house and saw him rather casually dressed inside his garage with his back to us, and he was doing something with his golf clubs. And we just spoke to him and said, we wondered if you'd be interested in studying the Bible, or if we'd like to invite you to some Bible study. It was like a lightning struck. He was ready for that. He had been thinking about this a long time. And he began to tell his story. He said, I'm a Roman Catholic, went to Roman Catholic grade schools, Roman Catholic high schools, Roman Catholic college, and I've had it up to here. I later was to find out that he's an officer in one of the parishes in Eau Claire, one of the Catholic parishes. But he felt the need to know God and to know his will. And immediately he came. That was Sunday afternoon. He came Monday night, was back Wednesday night, and was out of town the rest of the time. But there's opportunity there. This story can be multiplied many times. 49 prospects, David said, that were described as very good for a Bible study. A stack of cards. About the same number who are interested but were unwilling at that particular moment to make a definite date for a Bible study. And about 60 some odd that were friendly and were going to be followed up on. Great deal of work to be done by those few. There will be some who will come in to help, but we need to pray for them. And more than anything else, we need to be busy doing that right here. We may not go to these other places, although it's going to be a great opportunity, I think, for Christians in this assembly to do this very often. They're already pressing me about where we're going to go next year. We've got a group that they're already thinking about next year. I'm not ready to answer that question. I've told them maybe we'd go down to Betsy Lane, Kentucky. I don't know, that didn't stir the blood, did it? But that's a great place down there, and we're helping a young man preach in Betsy Lane. And if you can't go to Wisconsin, maybe you can go to Betsy Lane and help out for a day or two or three. And we could do. I'm not speaking for those brethren. They don't even know I'm thinking these thoughts. Some other places. But one thing is absolutely sure, we can work for the Lord in this city. And I'll tell you something. I believe we're going to do it. I have confidence in the people in this congregation. Even those of us who haven't quite awakened yet, I still believe, most confident, that there is in you a heart of deep concern that just has not surfaced fully.
But I will work along with many others to see that flower blossom in you so that others will hear the gospel and be saved. At least they'll hear it from earnest hearts. If you're not a disciple of the Lord this morning, if your heart is not fully His, this is your opportunity. Here you are, alive, breathing, and God in His mercy is delaying the final hour. And He will not spare in His love and goodness toward you. There is nothing you've done He will not forgive absolutely without condition, save one. And that is an obedient faith as you reach out to take His gift. It is necessary for you, like Noah of old, to trust Him absolutely, to put your life in His hands. And if you will come this morning believing in His Son, confessing that faith without shame, a faith that turns away from self and turns to Him in absolute submission, and then you are baptized into the Christ, buried in the water as He was buried in the heart of the earth, raised up by God's grace and power, and cleansed from every sin, you'll be. You'll be a Christian. You'll be God's child. And you can do that right now while we're standing and inviting you to come to the front, take your place here, ready to confess the Lord while we're singing.